Shanti Zerua Aleph Bet Gimel Yud Tav Tzadi. This verse, the six letters of a gematria of 506, connects us to the phrase Ahavat Hinam, unconditional love, and also to the name of God, Bav Shin Resh, a name that deals with memories, and memories in the context of being able to see patterns in our life, patterns from this life and patterns from earlier incarnations. Kaver rinat amcha sagbeinu taharenu no ra kufreshayim sintet nun. These six letters spell two Hebrew words, kra satan. Kra means to tear up. Satan is the name of the negative force that gives us free will. The same letters can be rearranged, permutated, to spell sha'ar katan, meaning small gates. And it's a hint to us to guard our gates, the eyes, ears, nose, and mouth, which are the entry point for the negative system. Nagibor Dorshe Yehud Ha Kevavat Shamrem Nun Gimel Dalet Yud Kaf Shin. Nun Gimel Dalet, through its gematria of 57, connects us to the Hebrew word Zan, which means parnasah, or sustenance. Yud Kaf Shin is a sequence that helps us to take back the energy we've given to the negative system through our mistakes. Barchem tacharem rachamei sidkacha tamid gamlem betet resh saritav gimel. The letter Kaf that created the sun that has two names in Hebrew, Choten, meaning hot, and Shemesh, meaning servant. When we're doing our spiritual work, then we can hear what the sun has to say. When we're not doing our spiritual work, the sun will burn us. That's what hot represents. Servant represents when we're doing our work. The tet looks like a womb, but we're over the 9 days. We're out of the pregnancy and moving into the positive aspect. But the tet is the letter that created the constellation Aryeh, the lion. And the lion is connected through its gematria to the 216 letters of the 72 names of God. Chasim kadosh berov tucha na'el adatach het kuf bet tet nunayim. Yachid ge'er lamcha b'nei zokrei kidushatak yud gimel lamed hei zayin kuf. This sequence helps to speed the spreading of the wisdom of Kabbalah during this, our generation. Shavatenu kabel u'shma tziyakatenu Yodea Talot Shin Kuvav Tzadi Yud Tav. The first two letters, Shin and Kuv, have a gematria of 400. 400 connects us to completion and to perfection. The last four letters have the gematria of the first verse, 506, and connect us to Ahavatinam and to the name of God, Bab Shin Resh. And we learn from all of this that the path to completion, the path to perfection, is through the injection of unconditional love. And in recognizing the patterns of behavior where we have made the same mistake time after time, and changing that action so it's no longer a mistake. And the eighth verse we say in a whisper. I'm reading a verse from the Zohar. Yes, please. V'yechanan. I'm going to I'm looking at verse 140. Vayehi Noam Adonai Eloheinu aleinu maaseh yadeinu peronei aleinu maaseh yadeinu peroneihu. Amar Rabbi Abba Ahadra Darna La Ravia Havta Man Derachim Lekucha Barichu Itatar Bechesed Mikol Sidrin Viave Chesed Bekolam Vilach Ayes Al Dufe Vial Mamone Minalan Ma Abraham Kima De Itmar De Halachas Virchi Muta De Mare Alibe Vial Nafshe Vial Mamone. Rabbi Abba said, let us return to the verse, and you shall love. Whoever loves the Holy One, blessed be He, is adorned with chesed in every direction, does kindness with everyone, and cares not for his body or money. We derive that from Abraham, as we learned, who for love of his master had no pity on his own heart, soul, or money. I don't think that that verse is meant to say you can abuse your body, but otherwise I think it's fairly clear. Does anybody have any questions before we begin tonight's class in the 10 Luminous Emanations? Okay. We are reading from the section called Histaklut Pnimit of chapter 1 of Rabbi Ashlag's Esther Sefirot, usually translated as 10 Luminous Emanations. Last week we completed section 1, where we were talking about the concept of one, unique, and unified. And we were looking the learning the definitions of these three different words. When he acts with one, when he unites to act with one force, referring to the Creator, he is called unified. When he divides to act his act, each part of him is called unique. And when he is in a single evenness, he is called one. Thus far, his pure words, referring to the Ramban's commentary on the Sefer Yetzirah. And I'll put in a plug for those of you who want to join us and learning about astrology and meditation, which are what primarily the discussions and the verses of the Sefer Yetzirah teach us. That class is Monday nights at 7 p.m. But I think I need to discuss this idea of a single evenness. It's really something we don't have in our world. In the endless world, there is light that is a single evenness. There is a vessel that is fulfilled by that light and yet is concealed by that light, so that the vessel appears as a single evenness. This is the unity, the oneness that is in the Ein Sof, that is so hard for us to understand because it's a paradox. But even on the simple level of the light that is even, there's no grades, there's no measurement, there's no perception of a difference. In the words of Rabbi Ashlag, or in the words of the Etz Chaim, it says there is no grade, no difference, no perception. Sweetness, the taste of something sweet and the taste of something bitter, in the concept of one, there's no difference. I think I told you the story last week of Rabbi Ashlag, who suffered from diabetes, was not allowed sugar, and he used to love sugar in his tea. So his students would bring him the tea, and he would take a cube of sugar, and he would hold the cup of tea in his right hand and the sugar in his left hand. He'd look at the sugar, and he'd take a sip of tea. And then he'd shake his head and say, "No, it's too sweet." He'd put the cup down, and he'd break the sugar cube in half. And then he would repeat the process. And he would say, "This tea is just right, just sweet enough." He was perceiving with his taste buds something that wasn't there, but is in the oneness of the tea. The tea does not have to have the sugar put in it, if you're on the right consciousness. This is what we strive for, to be in oneness with the Creator. That oneness means there's no separation. My personal first meditation took place during the reading of the Scroll of Esther on Purim. And I typically, what happens in meditations is you receive an amazing experience, and then you spend the rest of your life striving to get it back. And this was an amazing experience. I'm going to try and verbalize it, and of course it can't be verbalized. But I'm listening to the scroll, and in a Kabbalistic minhag, there's no noise. Whenever the name Haman is mentioned, we meditate on the three letters on the name of God, Kaf Hei Taf, because that is an essence of a light, a laser-like beam, very narrowly focused, to destroy negativity. So we meditate on that, and as I'm meditating on this name, I go somewhere. And then I realize that I'm not where I was. And I look back, and I realize where I was within the light. And I'm struggling to get back to this. I don't want to leave it. I'm yearning for this unity, this oneness that I only experienced once in my life. And there for a second, maybe it was 30 seconds, maybe it was a minute, maybe it was a half hour, I don't know. I don't know where we started and when we stopped, but I wanted that unity. I yearn for that unity. It is a gift that I've been given to experience. Can't describe what it means to be oneness. Does anybody have any questions on the idea of oneness, uniqueness, and unified, and how they are different? They're the same light, acting in a different sense, acting in a concerted way, differently. And we need to understand when the light acts in a different way. And that's why we use words that describe these different ways. They're not unique things in the physical world. They're not unified in the physical world. They're describing spiritual essences, but they're using physical concepts that we're all used to. Never think of this as something physical. Rabbi Ashlag cautions us all the time. There's all these drawings of the tree of life, and all they do is confuse you. Because you're seeing something in the two dimensions that is in multi dimensions.
I have a question.
Yes, Ari.
Would it be like take a beam of sunlight? That's your unified whole. That's what we see. And you shine it through a prism. And now it separates into the colors of the spectrum, some of which we can and cannot see. Yet we know that the things we cannot see can be picked up with certain instruments, so we know they're there. Is that one way to describe it?
No, that's one way to describe unique. It's not oneness.
Okay, that's where I was getting confused. So, I mean, if I... My example would say everything is emanating from our perspective, what we see, as one. But when we shine into the prism, we can see difference. And yes. That's what you're saying is uniqueness.
That's uniqueness. It's not.
And therefore we can perceive that in the physical world.
Correct. There is no ability to perceive oneness in the physical world.
You okay.
Can sense it, you can experience it. And in that sense, it's a perception. But it can't be verbally described. Bob has a question.
I was just going to say that when I was listening in, we're broken.
Bob is suggesting, please, to mute your microphones because there's some feedback going on and it's being able to be heard by other people, so I don't know if any of you are getting it, but it's better to mute your microphone and then when you want to ask a question to unmute it.
That's why Anouk's microphone was cutting in and out and you couldn't hear everything you were saying before.
I'm starting to read the section titled Two Discernments in Bestowal. Before it is received and after it is received. And that's section 2. We should learn from those who ate the manna. Manna is called bread of the sky. Because it did not materialize when clothing in this world. Our sages said that each and every one tasted everything he or she wanted to taste within it. That means it had to have opposite forms in it. One person tasted sweet and the other tasted it as acrid and bitter. Thus, the mana itself had to have been contained of both opposites together. For can one give what it is not in it, in one? How can two opposites be contained in the same carrier? It is therefore a must that it is simple and devoid of both flavors, but only included in them in such a way that the corporeal receiver might discern the taste he or she wants. In the same way, you can perceive anything spiritual. It is unique and simple in itself, but consists of the entire multiplicity of forms in the world. When falling in the hand of a corporeal receiver, it is the receiver who discriminates a separate form in it. Unlike all other forms that unite in that spiritual essence, we should therefore always distinguish two discernments in his bestowal. This form of the essence of that Shefa Elyon before it is received, when it is still inclusive or Pashut, simple light, and after the Shefa has been received, and thus acquired one separate form according to the properties of the receiver. That is very clear to me. I'm sure it's not as clear to you, because when I first read it, I had no idea what those words meant. But since I first read it, I've had meditative experiences, and I've had students try and describe meditative experiences. And one of those experiences are you are having a conversation with a rooster that becomes a beautiful woman, that becomes yourself, that becomes a hat. Maybe it's in a dream, maybe it's in a vision, maybe it's in a meditation. But you have these experiences where the communication is coming from different objects. Whether they're entities or objects, the communication is coming from those locations. And if you ever stopped to ask, why do you look like a rooster? They will tell you, because you want me to. The uniqueness, the oneness, I'm going to be careful with this, the oneness of the fulfillment before it is received by anything lower than it. Is different than what the entity below it perceives it as. And so we have two states. The states in a higher level that is in oneness, and the state in the lower level that has been received and impacted and interacted with. Modern physics describes this as the uncertainty principle. You cannot measure the speed of an object and its location at the same time. Why not? Because the perceiver, the measurer, changes the object. That rule, that law of physics, is not yet explained by modern physics in its broadest sense. But this is what Rabbi Aschlag is explaining here. We receive, and in the reception we change what we receive. Not only do we change what we receive, but we have the potential to change ourselves. How can I apply that in my life today? All the time. You're having a conversation with somebody at work. Did you hear him correctly or her correctly? Were the words expressed? How did you understand their meaning? Was it a narrow frame of reference for you or a broader frame of reference? Was it coming from the general or was it coming from the specific? Know that you modify what you receive. Therefore, you can start to search for the broader context. If you don't realize that you modify what you're receiving, then the emotions you're feeling are just that, the emotions you're feeling, and you're going to be reactive to them. People many times ask me, how do I stop my reaction? And I'm not able to give them this understanding until they start to learn the 10 luminous emanations. You stop your reaction by realizing that you're having a reaction. By realizing that you are changing what you receive. Any questions? The next section, how can we perceive the neshama as a part of godliness? Let's understand something. What's neshama? It's the soul. It's the highest level of soul that typically resides in the body. It leaves the body when the body does a negative action, meaning you do the negative action. The neshama rarely gets involved and harmed by those negative actions. It leaves. But how do we perceive the neshama as part of godliness? Number three. Now we can come to understand what the Kabbalists write about the essence of the neshama. The neshama is a part of God above and is not at all changed from the whole, except in that the neshama is a part and not the whole. It is like a stone that is carved off a mountain. The essence of the mountain and the essence of the stone are the same. And there is no discernment between the rock and the mountain, except that the rock is a part and the mountain is the whole. This is the essence of their words. It seems utterly perplexing and very difficult to understand how there could be a part and separation from godliness that we could resemble to a stone that is carved off a mountain. The stone may be carved off the mountain by an axe and a sledgehammer, but in dealing with godliness, how would they be separated and with what? There's a few questions in this section. What is the difference between the stone and the mountain. Size. Can I measure the size? I can measure the size of the mountain. I can measure the size of the stone. I can draw inference about the relationship, about the, what's the word, the mathematical word? The
inheritance.
No, not the inheritance. The
correlation.
The correlation.
The correlation. I'm thinking in terms of a ratio. I can measure the two and have a ratio. Can I do that with godliness? Can I do that with a soul?
No. Because that's, you're trying to measure infinite.
Godliness is infinite. Is the neshama infinite?
No.
But our soul supports this aspects of it.
Bob is asking the question, when the neshama splits, doesn't it create two different aspects? The point, the answer to your question is, you haven't told me how it's going to split. How does the soul split? This is the question that we're going to answer in the next section. And until we know how it splits, we can't answer the question. Because maybe there are two parts of the same thing. Maybe my soul and your soul and Marcia's soul are three parts of God. And all together we form God. And by myself, I form God. Can I do what God can do? Do I have access to all of the information that God has access to? Why not? If I'm God, why not? But I'm only using 2% of my brain. Maybe that 98% makes me God. And I have access to all of that information. All of the discussion of the, whatever the modern age calls them, the Acacia records. Maybe that's God's filing system. We don't know. I'm making this up, guys. It isn't this filing system. But I'm trying to give you an understanding of how the words we use describing physicality, and we're talking about spirituality, and we need to make that growth. We need to recognize it, remember it, and know it constantly. How does a neshama split is in section 4, which I'm about to read you. The spiritual is divided by shinui tsura, as the corporeal is divided by an axe. Shinui means second, two. Tsura means soul, from Aramaic. Before we come to clarify the matter, we shall explain the essence of the separation. In spirituality, know that spiritual entities become separated one another only by shinui tsura. In other words, if one spiritual entity acquires a second tsura, then it is no longer one, but two. Actually, I've confused you. Tsura means phase. As in the four phases, which not all of you have studied. But as I said, at the time I teach this, the four phases, and I recommend you listen to that. If you don't understand the four phases, it's going to limit your continuation in the depths of Kabbalah. Surah means phase. So one spiritual entity acquires a second phase, a second surah. How does it acquire a second surah? Let's talk about the oneness, the uniqueness of phase one, where the light is fulfilling the vessel, where the coffee cup is filled to the brim with hot coffee. Did the coffee cup change by being filled by the coffee? Not initially, but as time, as process, as physicality generates, the coffee cup gets warm because the coffee was hot. What fulfilled it causes the vessel to change. The coffee cup is now different than it was. It has reached a second phase. It has taken on the attribute of what fulfilled it. In the case of the coffee, heat. In the case of spirituality, the essence of the light is to share. The essence of the vessel is to take on the attribute of I want to share. The essence of the Creator is to share. The essence of the vessel is I want to share. Are they the same thing? No. They're different by virtue of the consciousness of being a vessel. I'm continuing to read from Rabbi Ashlag. Let me explain it in souls of people who are also spiritual. It is known that the spiritual rule, that in a simple form there are many souls, as there are bodies where the souls shine. However, they are separated from one another by the Shnui Tzura in each and every one. What separates the souls within a body? Well, let's talk about it. How many souls does a body have? Hanoch ben Yaakov has 613 parts of his body. That's what the sages teach us. Hanoch ben Yaakov has 613 parts of his soul. One for every part of his body. Each of those has a name. Each of those has a function. And each of those is unified in the name Hanoch ben Yaakov. Our sages said, as their faces are not the same, so their opinions are not the same. The goof can discern the tzura of the souls and tell if each specific soul is a good soul or a bad soul. Likewise with the separated forms. You now see that just as the corporeal matter is carved, severed, and becomes separated by an axe in motion to increase the distance between each part, so a spiritual matter is divided, cut, and becomes separated by the second phase, the Shinui Tzura, between each part. According to the difference, so is the distance between the parts, and remember that well. What is distance in a spiritual world? It isn't a meter, 3 feet, 4 inches, 12 miles. Distance in the spiritual world is separation of form, a different consciousness. The second phase of the coffee cup is hot. It has a different consciousness. It has accepted what the fulfillment wanted to give it, and it became something else. Is there a disappearance of the first? Is the coffee cup still there? The answer is yes, it's still there, but it is not the same. It's called a reshimo, but that's a different subject that I don't want to confuse you with. I just needed to say it. The next question, how can there be a Shinui Tzura in creation with respect to the Ein Sof? Section 5. It is now clear in Olam Hazeh, this world, in the souls of people. However, in the Neshama of which they said it is a part of God above, it is still unclear. How is it separated from godliness to the point that we can call it a godly part? We should not say by Shinui Tzura, for we have already said that godliness is or pashut, simple light, unified, one, which contains the entire complete multiplicity of the forms and the oppositeness of the forms in the world, as he is one, unique, and unified. In that case, how can there be a Shinui Tzura in the Neshama that would differ it from godliness, separate it and become a part of him, become a part, separated from him? Indeed, this question applies to the Or Ein Sof prior to the Tzimtzum. For in the reality before us, all the worlds, upper and lower, are discerned by two discernments. The first discernment is the form of the entire reality, as it is before the Tzimtzum. At that time, everything was without start and without end. This discernment is called Ein Sof, endless. The second discernment is the form of this entire reality from the Tzimtzum downwards. Then everything became limited and measured. This discernment is called the four worlds, Atzilut, Briah, Yetzirah, in Asiya. It is known that there is no perception whatsoever in Atzimut. And everything that we do not attain and that has no name and appellation, how can we define it by a name? Any name implies attainment. It indicates that we have attained that name, that level of consciousness. Thus it is certain that there is no name or appellation whatsoever in the Atzimut. Instead, all the names and appellations are but in his Or. Potentially, in simple light, is green, red, orange, and brown. But it's not there till I perceive it. Do I need the prism to perceive it? In the physical world, yes. In the spiritual world, no. I can perceive it with my mind's eye without a physical prism. But it's the same. The light is simple. The light is separated. What causes the separation? My consciousness, my perception that I see orange and not red. Is red orange? Can red be orange? In the endless world, they're the same. Can I see it in the physical world? in order to remove the concept of hatred for no reason, I have to see what is separated from me is not separated from me. I have to look at the five fingers of my hand that seem separated and realize they're one hand. I have to realize that you and I and everybody listening to the future recordings all have to see one vessel with different desires, different potential desires, one vessel. Those different desires, are they truly different? Are they really different? In the endless world, they're not different. Sweet and bitter is oneness. In our world, in our perception, as I've been fulfilled with the essence of that other person, as their energy comes into me, I change it and see them as separated. That aura expands from him, and the hit pashtut of his light before the tzimtzum, which had filled the entire reality without start and end, is called En Sof. Thus we should understand how Or En Sof is defined in and of itself and has left his atzmut, so that we may define it by a name, as we have said about the neshama. Atzmut means essence. I waited till now to define it. The neshama is the essence of what is perceived by the lower levels within the oneness of Or En Sof. The explanation about the text of our sages. Hence there has been work and labor prepared for the reward of the neshamot, for one who eats that which is not one's own is afraid to look upon one's face. To somewhat understand this sublime place, we must go into further detail. We shall research this entire reality before us and its general purpose. Is there an operation without a purpose? And what is that purpose for which he has invented this entire reality before us in the upper and the lower worlds? Indeed, our sages have already instructed us in many places that all the worlds were not created but for Israel, who keeps Torah and mitzvot, etc. And this is well known. However, we should understand this question of our sages. They asked, if the purpose of the creation of the worlds is to delight his creatures, then why did he create this corporeal, turbid, and tormented world? Without it, he could certainly delight the neshamot as much as he wanted. Why did he bring the neshama into such a foul and filthy body? They explained it with the verse, one who eats that which is not one's own is afraid to look upon one's face. It means there is a flaw of shame in any free gift. In order to spare the neshamot, this blemish, he has created this world where there is work. They will therefore enjoy their labor, for they take their pay from the whole in return for their work. and are thus spared the blemish of shame. We've just seen how bread of shame, the concept, is explained and enhanced by Rabbi Ashlag. Anything you eat that isn't your own, you can't look the other person in the eye. You can't look in his face. Your consciousness is uncomfortable. Now, I know a lot of people are going to tell me, I'll take that free ride anytime. Give me that free lunch. You know who gets free lunch? The children of the wealthy. And what's the effect of the children of the wealthy? The greatest chaos, the most unhappy people, the greatest amount of suicide. Why? Because within the Creator there is no shame. Within us there cannot be shame, or it separates us from the Creator. This is the process of this world, its purpose of existence. Now Rabbi Ashlag is asking a question, and I'm not going to go further to explain it, but the question is really wonderful. What is the connection between working 70 years or 120 years or 300 years or 1,000 years and eternal delight? And you will not find a greater free gift than that. How can the equivalent of work for a lifetime or 1,000 lifetimes equal the fulfillment of the endless world? I'm going to leave you here, just as my teacher left me here, to contemplate this week. What is this meaning? How do I answer this question? Does anybody have any questions? Tonight at 10, we will be giving a class or talking a class on the writings of Rabbi Brandwein through his letters to Rabbi Berg. They're rather, lots of spiritual laws can be learned from them. Tomorrow night at 5 LA time and 10 LA time will be a Zohar class, two of them. You're all invited. And Sunday morning at 10 a.m., we will be doing the class on the Hebrew letters. We'll be talking about the Gimel. I think the last few classes have been rather phenomenal in how people experience them. Come and try it, see whether you like it or not. Any other questions before I hang up?
Rest well, Illinois.
You too, Chris. Everybody have a beautiful evening.